From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, 10 years after Texas raids the Yearning for Zion Ranch and took 468 children from the religious sect, what happened to them and what do they think about that raid today? And how Texas could lose money and political power with the new census question about citizenship. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On March 29, 2008, a Texas domestic violence shelter hotline received a call from a female claiming to be a 16-year-old victim of physical and sexual abuse at the Yearning for Zion Ranch. The YFZ Ranch was located 40 miles outside of San Angelo, just outside of the town of El Dorado. Members of the Fundamentalist Latter-day Saints Church had moved to the area to develop the ranch. They sought the isolation of the area to avoid the scrutiny of anti-polygamy activists and law enforcement officials. The caller said her name was Sarah, but Sarah was never found. But the call triggered a large-scale operation by Texas law enforcement and child welfare officials. On April 3rd, they cordoned off the ranch. Law enforcement officials were armed with automatic weapons, SWAT teams with snipers, helicopters, and an armored personnel carrier all went onto the property. They met no armed resistance. Also entering the compound were caseworkers from the Texas Child Protective Services. They were there to take the 468 children into the care of the state. Eventually, Warren Jeffs, the leader of YFZ, and nine other men were convicted for sexually abusing young girls. Jeffs is serving a life sentence for sexually assaulting a 14-year-old and another teen that he had taken as wives. Here is one of the children, Rulon Hamilton. He was taken from his family on the ranch, given a CPS caseworker, placed with a foster family, later adopted. He was 8 years old at the time, now 18. He remembers Jeff's and life on the ranch.
Yeah, it wasn't terrible. We lived in a trailer house, I remember, before then mostly. And Warren Jeffs would like ride on four-wheelers every now and then. It was out in the middle of nowhere. He would actually come out on a four-wheeler and visit us like once or twice a week maybe. And then we'd see him at meeting time or whatever. And that's like my main memory before he went into jail, which was 06, I think.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of, yeah, we lived in a small trailer, there was no power, and there was barely any water, and it wasn't like a terrible place, but it wasn't the best either before.
Hamilton also has a clear memory of that day when his life took that unexpected turn when the raid happened.
There was that day where the cops were out at the gate, and it was kind of, that day was just kind of mellow, not really much happened, and then the next day, we started hearing that the FBI was out there, more cops were showing up, and they were starting to ask really weird questions about what was going on the ranch, and, you know, school was canceled, they started telling everybody to just stay in their homes, because the cops might end up being on the property, on the ranch, coming in. So, that was the official start for me, was when that day, everything kind of started all intense to begin with. But they started asking everybody, all the girls, to locate in one place, all the underage girls. And that's when the panic officially started. And Warren Jeffs didn't even know what was going on. And I remember that was the craziest, probably, as far as the starting of it goes.
Nate Carlisle is a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. He found Hamilton and four other children from the YFZ ranch, and he wrote the story. I expected the world to be in flames. Hear from the children taken from the Texas polygamous compound 10 years after the raid.
I thought it was important to go and talk to the kids now. I mean, a lot of these kids, if they're old enough to remember anything at all, or old enough to talk about the experience 10 years later. And we heard so much from adults back then. Some of it was untrue. Some of it wasn't forthright. And I thought it was time to give the kids a chance to talk.
What do the kids remember?
They kind of remember bits and pieces, at least the younger ones do. They remember kind of flashes of the law enforcement coming on the ranch. They remember being taken away from the ranch. They remember being separated from their mothers. They remember being sent to foster homes across Texas, and they remember the unifications. You know, they're hazy on some details. For example, some kids don't even know where in Texas they were taken to once they were put in foster homes, or what the names of the homes were, or the names of the caretakers at the homes. Some of them only recently learned why Texas came on the ranch in the first place. I mean, the FLDS were telling the kids that, the government was out to get Warren Jeffs, and they were telling lies about the leaders. And now they know quite a bit more than that.
Some of the kids described that at the time during the raids that they thought this was the actual end of the world. I mean, that must have been traumatizing.
It was, and some of them didn't necessarily think it was the end of the world as much as, God would send his wrath down to those sinning against the FLDS. They were told a lot of bad things about the outside world before the raid, and that was one of the things they had to overcome, both to cope with the raid itself, and then years later, some of them, when they did leave the FLDS.
So some of these children were victims of sexual exploitation at this ranch. So have they ever gotten the help that they needed, the treatment, the counseling to deal with all that?
Well, the five children I interviewed, if they were victims of sex abuse, they didn't disclose that to me. Certainly among the 468 kids, yes, there's some victims of sex abuse in there. And that's one of the big questions. Where are all these kids now, and are they getting the help that they need? I was able to get five to speak with me. I was able to reach some more than that. There were many who didn't want to speak with me or didn't want to speak with me on the record for the article. But there's still a lot of mysteries about what's happened to not just the 468 kids, but other people in the FLDS, and where are they now?
What condition are they in?
That depends on the kid to kid. It varies greatly. One child we interviewed, Rulon Hamilton, we've written about previously, he's been adopted by a family here in Salt Lake City, he's doing well. He's progressed in the last few years and is a pretty average kid now. One kid I interviewed is still a kid. She's 14, and she's going to school with her family now down in Hilldale, Utah. They're all out. I'd say they all have some issue to some extent, and they're all trying to move forward with life and cope as best they can.
At the time of the raids, we did hear stories about how horrible this was on the children, and that the children were being taken away from their parents and put into the Texas Child Protective Services. And that was an ordeal that, shouldn't have happened to them, according to the representatives of the FLDS organization. What do we know now, looking back? The proper steps were taken, or were there lessons to be learned?
I can only tell you what the five kids I interviewed for the article told me. None of them described the raid as fun, but they understand now why Texas did it. They have a mixed bag of feelings. Removed from their home, removed from their parents, removed from their families. But they all realize now the sex abuse that was going on, the splitting of families, which was occurring on the ranch. And they don't, none of them go so far as to say, good job, Texas. But none of them go so far as to say, you absolutely should not have done that either.
What is the relationship with these children now with the FLDS?
Well, the five children I interviewed are no longer part of the FLDS. They may have family still in, but that's the extent of the associations they have now with the FLDS.
Was the raid a factor in their leaving the FLDS?
A couple of them said yes, the raid was a factor, that it showed them the outside world wasn't as bad as what they were led to believe. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of people that have left the FLDS over the last 10 years, and there's usually a multitude of reasons. It has to do with how they were treated by the leaders in the group. These kids in particular, like I said, a couple said, yeah, the raid was a factor in helping them persuade to leave or have the strength to leave later. But others, there's a long list of reasons why people leave the FLDS.
After the raid, they did DNA testing on everyone. Why did they do that, and what did they find?
They were looking for evidence. They were trying to figure out, whose child was who the parents are. And in the case of, the pregnant teenagers or teenagers that already had children, they were trying to identify the fathers. And if you go and look at the men who were convicted of sex crimes in Texas, that was the evidence. They were able to show with DNA testing and some other paper records that were found on the ranch.
So they were able to determine that elders in the church, the men that were at the hierarchy of the church, were the fathers of the children from these teenagers.
They weren't necessarily in the hierarchy, but men in the faith, yes.
What kind of reaction are you getting for your story?
A lot of people were glad I was able to clarify some questions they'd had earlier. You know, we'd heard way back in 08 that, for example, kids were being coached to cry and misbehave and say they wanted their parents and stuff like that. Sarah Bell Steed, who was believed to be the oldest child taken, was able to confirm some of that yes, she was coached to do that. And
I found that to be one of the interesting takeaways from the piece, was like learning about, we saw the reaction, we saw the theatrics from some individuals and claiming certain things about how they're being treated. And then now we can come back and look at it and say this was part of a strategy to deflect a blame from the church onto law enforcement.
Well, the reactions to how they were being treated, yes. There's still people that will tell you that irrespective of what the reactions from the FLDS were, they still didn't like being confined to a shelter in El Dorado in San Angelo, Texas. But yes, it is correct that the FLDS were coaching women and children to kind of act out.
Nate Carlisle is a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. He followed up on what was one of the biggest stories to rock Texas in 2008, the raid of the YFZ Ranch. The story is called "I Expected the World to Be in Flames." Hear from the children taken from the Texas polygamous compound 10 years after the raid. The U.S. Census Bureau announced plans to include a question about citizenship status in the 2020 census form. This question has prompted questions about why was it suddenly added, and is it part of an effort by President Trump to politicize the national count? A group of 14 states, led by California but not including Texas, filed suit and are trying to force the Commerce Department to back down and leave the citizenship question off the census. But even if the block is successful, the damage might already been done. Non-citizens who are already wary of a hostile administration are now even less likely to participate in the census with or without that citizenship question. Certainly throwing off the count of who's present in America, that data is used to determine congressional apportionment, it's used to allocate federal funding for infrastructure and education, and it serves as the basis for huge amounts of American research. Rice University sociologist Steve Murdoch is the former director of the Census Bureau.
If I'm not a citizen and I'm worried about, you know, that factor affecting me in many, many things, I probably am not going to answer that question in the census. I'm not likely going to say I'm not a citizen if you have a citizenship question. I may decide not to answer it at all. The concern, at least that I have when you look at that, is that in some cases it will be fear that may not be founded. But I think if you are an undocumented person living in any place that I know of in the Southwest, you're probably not going to answer that question. So someone says, well, what's the difference? Well, the difference will be as if my area is being allocated resources on the basis of citizens, okay, but I have a lot of non-citizens who are using services in my area, then that's a problem for me. We would need to make the reason that we need that question a lot more specific than we presently are doing.
Having an undercount in a state like Texas, how much would it hurt the state to, would we miss out on a few million dollars or what?
I don't have a calculation for that. I haven't done that calculation. But clearly, you know, you can see in part who's upset with this particular set of things. And you can see that the group that has gone forward already with legal matters has been California. And California is second only to us in terms of diversity of population and the same kind of population. Now, they have, unlike us, I think they have a little bit different political distribution of key elected officials, but I'm not sure exactly what they have. But you know, they have been immediate in filing suit because of their concern about this issue.
But California is claiming that they're going to miss out tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars from the feds. Texas, being Texas, with a very similar population, as you pointed out, would miss out on the same amount of money. But Texas is not going to sue because of, I guess, we have a political leadership that is more aligned with what we have now in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, that's not necessarily the causal factor, but certainly our response is quite different than California's response. And yes, they have a larger population and hence a larger Hispanic population. But you know, we aren't so different from them that you would expect us to have the differences that you see in what's happening in the two areas.
The U.S. Census Department, what would be the upside for them to ask this question?
That isn't clear to me. They may feel like they don't have a handle on diversity. They're one of the things that they are doing, in my perception, and it's just from talking, not a systematic sample. But I think they are instilling some real fear in alien populations and in populations from other areas of the world that are making their homes in the U.S. I think I'm not sure what we get from that, but it is. I think it is one of the major effects, but a side effect of what they intend to do.
It's been reported that the Department of Commerce says they want to include this question in the census questionnaire about citizenship in order to get a better idea of what's happening with the Voting Rights Act. Does that make sense?
You know, the census has never been meddled in other kinds of things other than its census. In other words, it doesn't normally pick out something like voting and say, well, I'm going to really look into the demographics of that, and you know, other scientists take the data maybe and do that, but the census has been pretty much a straight up and down kind of agency that had a mandate and fulfilled that mandate, and has always tried to avoid the politics that could be in a census, and for good reason. If you look at the census in some European and other states over time, some of them have become, almost useless because they have become so politicized. And I think for particularly some of the old guard, and I would guess in the census and other places, they're quite concerned about what the implications of this might be.
Typically, we've seen in the past, and you were the director of the Census Bureau from 2007 and 2009, typically, you know, there's efforts to, during the census, is to reach out into communities where people are typically disenfranchised and highly suspicious of the census and try to...
I think that will occur. I mean, I don't think they're going to be less vigorous in their attempting to get everyone to respond. If you look at some of the censuses in the past, we've been very careful to say, you know, we don't care what your status is, so please answer the questions, and we're not going to ask you whether you're a citizen or not. Now you say, I want to know whether you're a citizen or not, and go, by the way, answer all the other questions. Well, that's good for the census and a broader thing, but if you're that individual and it's the first time you've ever been involved in the census where people were asking for your citizenship, and now you're being asked all those other things as well, which you normally would be asked. You're going to put the two together and say, what is it they're trying to do? I think they're going to say, what are you trying to do to me? You know, you want all this information on me. You say it's all protected, but, you know, I'm nervous.
Looking at the Texas-Mexico border, the Rio Grande Valley, could this have a big impact on how many federal dollars and resources go to that area?
Yeah, sure could. And it would with lots of areas because, you know, if you take our major cities, if you take, you know, the Austin area now, which is, you know, over 2 million, if you take the Houston area, of course, several million, and you add that to that, the Dallas area, you're talking about, you know, large numbers of people for whom they're asking some questions that may be difficult to obtain answers for. The census has a proud and long history, but if you go back and look at World War II, there were some things done that would we probably wouldn't like to know about today.
Like using the census data to find Japanese Americans who were later put in internment camps?
That's it. Yep.
The drawing up of political maps. We use census data to draw those maps to figure out who's going to get what congressional district.
Yeah.
If there is an undercount in certain areas with certain populations, then there is going to be, I'm asking the question, a loss of political power with that population.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. If you are undercounting significantly, you are diminishing the political power, if you will, of that group. So the inclusiveness of the census, be it by gender or by race, ethnicity, all of those kind of characteristics are important in terms of, in a sense, determining what your society is going to be like, your country is going to be like.
Rice University sociologist Steve Murdoch is the former director of the Census Bureau. He warns that adding the question about citizenship status to the 2020 census survey will create an undercount and hurt Texas with the loss of federal dollars and political power. Last weekend, the March for Our Lives protest took to the streets of Washington, D.C. and across the country. It was led by the survivors of the Parkland, Florida school shooting and has inspired many across the nation to question the enormous political power of the National Rifle Association. TPR contributor Yvette Benavidez watched the coverage of the march, and she says she can't help thinking about the students that she sees in her own classroom.
In literature class the other day, we studied a story by the contemporary author Ann Beatty. She's a perennial darling in The New Yorker, but she and her stories are otherwise mostly unfamiliar to my students. The bio in the anthology described her as belonging to the Me generation, a designation that surprised me as she and I grew up just a few years apart, and I had long been relegated to the Generation X niche sandwiched between boomers and millennials. The protagonist in Beatty's story develops an odd attachment to a ceramic bowl after deciding to stay in an unhappy, affectionless marriage. Our discussion went to Chekhov's gun, a literary trope that describes how every element of a story should contribute to the whole. That is, if a gun is hanging on a wall of a room in a story, that gun must be fired by story's end. In Beatty's enigmatically titled Janus, we considered the bowl at the start of the story and the final line, when the bowl is empty, representing the protagonist herself. I guess that character's in the Me generation too, said one student. It's all about her. And what generation are you, I asked, figuring Tumblr or some other social media platform had dictated the name and characteristics of those a year or two out of high school. We're the AR-15 massacre generation, he said. And the room went silent. The Oklahoma City bombing occurred on April 19, 1995. Singer Selena had been murdered just a few weeks before on March 31st. That spring seemed just like an awful conflation of events, not an epidemic of violence. Maybe cable news and its looped coverage gives the impression that things have gotten worse, brings us closer to the names and faces. But have things gotten worse? For some reason, in class, when my student referenced the killings at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School on Valentine's Day 2018, I instantly recall the massacre at the high school at Columbine. For reasons I've not considered much, that horrific event marks for me the start of the school shooting epidemic. On April 20, 1999, two students went on a killing spree that left 12 students and one teacher dead and dozens more injured. My brain is quick with rhetorical figures and literary analysis and slow with numbers, but I did the math and I was struck by the idea that most of the students sitting before me in the literature class weren't more than 2 or 3 years old themselves when that dastardly, unthinkable event occurred. Who could even begin to fathom a day like December 14, 2012? And now, who can forget it? Sandy Hook, and Umpqua, and Virginia Tech, and all the other schools where normal is just another word, but no longer a fact of life. And then there is Parkland and the community from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Pundits query, why now? Out of all the many nightmarish school massacres, how is it that the students of that school have managed reactions that are not only vociferous, but heard, listened to? The students themselves have surmised that their community's affluence and the fact that most of the students are white is part of the reason. Even in their trauma and grief, they manage a plausible, honest response in considering these issues of equity. More incredible is the fact that even in their trauma and grief, they are attacked. In recent days, Laura Ingraham of Fox News mocked David Hogg, the tall, slim senior from the school who has emerged as something of a spokesperson, for not being accepted by 4 of the colleges to which he applied. David has a 4.2 GPA and has applied to many colleges with that stellar record. I don't doubt that this young man will find his place at a good school and go on to do great things. I doubt, however, that as an adult and a parent, he would ever use his position to belittle a victim of a school shooting. And hoaxers abound, and not just for school shootings. Even the clergy and congregation of Sutherland Springs have come under attack by hoaxers and right-wing news personalities trying to preserve the power of the NRA among other interests. Many of them have tagged the students of recent school shootings as crisis actors. It seems that victims of mass shootings will stay victimized for as long as they are able to survive and struggle to go on with their lives. What a cruel fate for such innocent children who are victims of the worst kind of circumstance and have already suffered so much. The young people who say they have never known life at school that did not include active shooter drills and living under the threatening pall that it could happen anywhere are joined too by teachers who hunker down in closets, who shield their young charges from bullets and madmen, and who every other day do whiplash turns when someone opens the classroom door unexpectedly or jump at the sound of a loud crashing sound somewhere down the corridor. I'm a teacher too. Every single day, the shadow of the nagging fear of an active shooter or some other violence on campus crosses my thoughts. The solution from some corners for counteracting school shootings is to have teachers carry weapons to class too. Teachers have, and some of them have ended up causing accidents. It's easy to imagine that a school full of teachers packing heat could easily turn into a war zone. If my students have come to a point in their college lives where they feel they are in the AR-15 massacre generation, then I'm with them. And the only gun we ever want to know about is the one at the end of a Chekhov story.
Yvette Benavidez is a Texas Public Radio contributor, a writer and a book critic. She teaches creative writing at Our Lady of the Lake University. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to. And you can find us anywhere you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.